Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, July 16, 2021, a hot and humid Tennessee July day. Here in our Nashville garden, we are starting to harvest yellow squash, cucumbers, and several varieties of peppers. Tennessee state parks are well known for the monumental natural landscapes. Roan Mountain and Savage Gulf come to mind. But also worth celebration, but perhaps not as well known, are numerous Tennessee state parks dedicated to Tennessee's history and cultural heritage. Listeners who might want to explore these sites should check out Alvin York Homestead, Pinson Mounds, Sycamore Shoals, Fort Loudoun, Fort Pillow, among others. Special among these historic and cultural areas is Red Clay Historic Park near Cleveland, Tennessee. This park preserves the last assembly grounds of the Cherokee Nation prior to their removal to Oklahoma in the tragedies of the Trail of Tears in the 1830s. The managing and interpretation of these historic and cultural sites present unique challenges for park managers. Yesterday, I had the opportunity to discuss the Red Clay Park with my guest, Dr. Danielle Shelton. Danielle has just completed her doctoral studies at Middle Tennessee State University's Center for Historic Preservation, attaining her PhD in public history. Her doctoral dissertation has been about the cultural landscape of the Red Clay site. Dr. Shelton's research has brought to light some exciting information highlighting the importance of red clay to the understanding of Cherokee history and of those difficult times. Her work has been and will be critical to augmenting the programs and exhibits at Red Clay. And so I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Dr. Danielle Shelton. Danielle Shelton, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Danielle, let's set the stage here. We're doing a Zoom meeting today, recording this. I'm in Nashville. Where are you?
I'm in Chattanooga.
Chattanooga. Okay. I know that you had been at MTSU and had been working at Red Clay, which is close to Chattanooga. So that's where you're residing now.
I lived there the whole time I was going to MTSU.
I see. Okay. So you were commuting back and forth. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk today with you about this exciting work that you're doing and have done involving Red Clay State Park and the history of the Cherokee Nation there and topics along those lines. But as we get started, it's kind of traditional in my program to ask our guest to tell us a little bit about themselves. And I'm curious, and my listeners are often curious about how people choose to get into conservation in its various forms, whether it be natural resources or cultural resources. Tell us about yourself and where you're from, and what were your inspirations to get into, in your case, cultural resources management?
Well, I grew up on a small family farm in outside of Dermott, Arkansas, down in the Delta. And having a close connection to the land has always been just part of me. I joined the military. I went overseas for 10 years, got my bachelor's in history while I was overseas, and came back to the University of Arkansas and got my master's specializing in medieval history. And then it's actually a little difficult to get a job in the United States.
I was going to say there's not a lot of call for that.
I took a break, and I had actually been working at the VA hospital doing volunteer coordination and event coordination.
Right.
And then I took a little break from that and really got into trying to build a really big garden and got into teaching people how to ferment their own food and drink. And did that for a while. And then we moved to Chattanooga and I just really wasn't finding much work for whatever reason. And I was like, you know, maybe I just need to go back to school. And I was like, I can go for a traditional history degree over at Knoxville, or I can go to Murfreesboro for a public history degree. And in all my travels and adventures, I'd been doing public history for over 20 years, and I didn't even know what it was.
Exactly. That's just so fun.
Yeah.
You and I have a lot of mutual friends in that program, and a couple that have been guests on this program. Zeta Law has been a guest, and Susan Knowles has been a guest. David Britton from you may know is the park superintendent at Dunbar Cave, is now a student out there. So it's a very fine program. And folks may be interested in a little bit of the history of that program, but during the Alexander administration, the governor sought to establish centers of excellence at the universities, and that was one that MTSU created. And it's just a terrific program. And how long were you there
4 years.
involved in that program?
4 years.
4 years. Wow.
Yeah, the PhD program
Right.
is a 4-year program. And I'll be graduating in just a couple weeks. Successfully defending my doctoral dissertation a couple weeks ago. So I'm officially Dr. Danielle now.
Well, congratulations to you. That is really a long slog. Now I know, and the reason for us dialing you up and having this conversation is because of the work that you've done at Red Clay State Park. I became aware of it in the recent issue of the Tennessee Conservationist magazine, and I commend people to find that's most recent issue because you have authored an article there which and in short form talks about your work. And so how did you get interested in red clay?
Well, when we first moved to Chattanooga, I was working in a temporary job for the Girl Scouts. And one of my colleagues there, I mentioned something about being interested in Cherokee history. And she was like, well, you should go to Red Clay. And I was like, well, what's that? And, you know, she was like, oh, well, it was a really important site for the Cherokee. And so my husband and I went out there and I just kind of fell in love with the place. If you've not been there,
Well, tell our listeners who have not been there exactly what the lay of the land is and where that little cute little park is.
so it lays on the border with Georgia down in Bradley County in the southwest corner of Bradley County. And it was the, you know, last capital of the Cherokee Nation before they were removed by the federal government in 1838. So the Cherokees still come there, especially now that it is public, you know, land again. They come, they do everything from praying to demonstrating, you know, aspects of their culture for other park visitors. But they're there often, and the park really tries to foster the relationships with all three of the federally recognized tribes of Cherokee.
So the nearest town of any size is Cleveland, Tennessee.
Actually, it's Cahuilla, Georgia. It's only 3 miles from Cahuilla, Georgia.
Okay, there you go. That's I've never been to that little town, so there it is. Tell us, and Red Clay as a state park, as I recall, became a state park in 79.
Yes, sir.
And I was just getting started at the Department of Conservation in those days. I didn't have any duties that involved state parks or that particular park, but I remember visiting there as that park was being developed, and I remember attending the opening of the visitor center there, and I remember the folks doing the exhibit work. Tell us a little more about the story of the Cherokee and that site. I know you've done quite a bit of work and have developed that story a little in more detail than had been expressed in the exhibits at that park before.
Yeah, we've part of the program at MTSU, we have to do a year's residency, and we have to have a public history project. So, since I was already writing about Red Clay, I did my residency out there, and I think really the main thing that I was supposed to do out there was to do interpretation in the summer, like park interpretation. I sew and do all kinds of craft work. So I made my costume so that I could be a missionary and went out there during the summer and spun yarn and talked to visitors about things that had happened there. During the period of significance, which was 1832 to 1838. So, what happened at Red Clay was that in 1828, the state of Georgia decided that they no longer wanted the Cherokees at all or the Creeks in their state anymore. And so they really started putting a lot of negative pressure on the native peoples to get out. And one of the laws that they passed basically said that if more than three native people met for any reason other than to cede their land, then they could go to prison for a few years. So the capital of the Cherokee Nation was at New Echota. So
In Georgia.
in Georgia,
Right, right.
down near Calhoun, I believe. And so they couldn't meet there. So in 18 that law went into effect in 1830. So in 1831 they met over in Chattooga, Alabama, near Galesville, or Galesburg, something like that. But that was too far for a lot of folks, especially the Cherokee coming from North Carolina, to make that meeting very easily. And so they moved it to Red Clay in 1832. There were 11 general councils there from between 1832 and 1838, or 37, I should say. And in 1838, the army began rounding them up at the end of May in 1838. And there were several what folks have always called them were removal forts that the Cherokee were put into. They were concentration camps, is what they were. By definition, they were concentration camps. And one of those was at Red Clay. There was a fort there that people were imprisoned in. They were there between 2.5, at least 2.5, possibly up to 4 months before they were moved to one of the immigration depots. Most likely, a lot of them I know went through Blythe's Ferry. Some of them may have also gone through Ross's Landing as well. And then they were deported out of their own nation to what is now Oklahoma.
To Oklahoma. The so-called Trail of Tears was the
They were not the only ones that left from there. Obviously, they also had enslaved people of African descent. And also, there were a large number of Creeks that had fled their own removal and had come to the Cherokee Nation.
Now, clarify what you're saying there to me. Now, you're mentioning slaves of African descent that were owned by the Cherokees. Is that what you're okay? And they were removed with the Cherokee. Okay. You know, it's a fascinating story, of course, that has parallels to modern times, unfortunately. I did not realize that there were prison encampments there. That's a new element of the story that to my mind.
Yeah, it sure was.
The
People died there. We don't know where they're buried, but they were likely buried there. But the council ground, what I've theorized, and I can't get any confirmation on this, of course, until there's some more extensive archaeology, at least some ground penetrating radar done. But the council ground was much larger than the present day park. It went up that valley because red clay's in this what do they call it? The ridge and valley section. It looks kind of, if you look at it from overhead, it kind of looks like a big washboard. And the park sits in this little valley between these two ridges. It actually, the western part of the park actually climbs one of the ridges, but that whole valley, you have Mills Creek that flows through it. You've got all kinds of springs. One of the major springs is at the park.
Right.
But that council ground probably extended about 4 miles north. And then there's a break in the ridge, and there's a road that goes through there now called Weatherly Switch. And I believe that part of the council ground went through there as well.
This
Because
is, you know, I remember vaguely the installation of exhibits and the interpretive timeline that was, you know, installed initially in the museum. Given the information that you've uncovered in your research, kind of made those exhibits a little dated, I presume.
we yeah so while I've been out at the park, I was actually out there working for over a year and a half, and so I'm just kind of I jump in with 2 feet when it's a place that I'm passionate about, and I see work that needs to be done. So what I ended up doing for my public history project is a renovation of the museum. So Tennessee State Parks was kind enough, since they knew that we were going to be doing this project. They put in new floors, repainted the walls, put in new lighting. I mean, it was from 40 years ago. It all needed to
Right,
be
right,
redone.
right.
And so they fixed up the room. I wrote 8 new interpretive panels to be added to the 6 panels that the NPSU Center for Historic Preservation wrote and installed back in 2015. So we curated some of the artifacts. You could go in there and see a bunch of like lithic artifacts, projectile points, and all kinds of things. And I honestly wanted to kind of, just put all of that in storage, honestly. But I know that a lot of the park visitors do come there for that. But that it doesn't totally add to the story that we're telling there.
Right.
But we found a way to incorporate some of those, but it's a much more curated selection than
Well,
what was.
tell us in more detail. What will the visitors see in the visitor center now?
Well, you'll see, well, the panels, they're kind of big. They're large, lovely panels on the walls that start with by telling about the archaeology that was done in the 1970s. there at the park. And then you'll have a curated selection of different artifacts. We've got pipes and chunky discs, and there's projectile points, like an ancient stone, or I'm sorry, a bone fishing hook. All kinds of interest. Some of our better, or I should say the cooler
Right,
kind
right.
of artifacts that we had in our collection. And then you'll actually see part of or see the rest of the story. I mean, we talk a bit about Cherokee culture, their traditional culture, and how it began to change with trade with the English and the French, and the Spanish. And then, quickly move on to Red Clay's actual story. One of the things that folks also don't realize about red clay is that during the height of the councils there in the 1830s, there were it was covered in buildings. You go there now and there's seven reconstructed Cherokee log buildings, some that represent the little kind of shack-like log cabins that were kind of thrown up for council visitors to stay in, all the way up to like a proper, hewn log farmhouse. But there, like in 1836, there were 91 log buildings at Red Clay.
And Daniel, how do we know that?
The 1836 Cherokee property evaluations. Once the federal government knew they were going to remove the Cherokee, they sent federal agents in to do a appraisals of the property,
To
and they
document that
also
thing, yeah.
and they did a census in 1835, and then in 1836 they did the property evaluation.
Where did you
But
find those records?
they're public records. I mean, they actually sell copies of the census at Red Clay. I think I
Okay.
got a copy there. The property valuations, Debbie Moore, who, if you don't know who she is, she's a retired teacher, but she's been instrumental in really promoting the history of Bradley County and the Trail of Tears in Tennessee. She's was just recently stepped down from being the president of the Tennessee chapter of the Trail of Tears Association. So she's
She's
very
sort of a
knowledgeable. She's
repository,
she is.
of all that information.
Well, she actually went through. There was a lady back in the 1980s who went to the archives, I believe in Nashville, and actually hand wrote all of the property evaluations, and it was published, but you can't really get your hands on it anymore. But Debbie went and found that book and actually transcribed it all, and then cross-referenced it with the census and some other records that we have to make it more usable. And she actually printed that and sells those. So between hers and I think Shirley Hoskins, I believe, was the lady who first wrote the stuff down in the 1980s. Between those two sources, you get a really good idea about what was happening, at least on the Tennessee side of the border, in 1836. But what I like to tell folks is both of those documents, while they seem comprehensive, it's just they're snapshots in time,
Sure
because
enough.
by 1835, two-thirds of the Cherokees living in Georgia were homeless, because the Georgia legislature had already started letting white folks come in and kick Cherokees off their land. So they weren't even removed, but they were in the process of being removed. Georgia allotted their lands according to a lottery. So you would pay like $18 for a chance to win 160 acres of land. And so folks were getting kicked off their land, including the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, John Ross.
Right. It occurs to me to ask what we're hearing a lot about. You're telling us the story of the legislative fervor in Georgia to remove the Cherokee. What was the legislative posture in Tennessee?
Well, I can't say that it was good. It just wasn't as bad as Georgia. There weren't as many Cherokee living in Tennessee. The majority of the nation was in Georgia by that period of time. And Georgia had been really trying to get all the native people out as early as the, I think, 1802 or so. The Georgia Compact, I think, actually gave them some legal, right to get everybody else out. And it wasn't even really that they needed the land. They were just racists.
Sure.
That's really what it came down to.
Well, and Andrew Jackson, of course, was had his role to play in that.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about that.
He he sure liked to use the Cherokee to attack the Creek back in 1813 in the First Creek War, which was part of the War of 1812. He got a group of Tennessee militia together, and then he had contacts in the Cherokee Nation and got Cherokee involved too, got a group of them to come down with them to defeat the Cree. And so by the time that they actually, the final real battle of that little war, was the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, down on the, I'm not going to embarrass myself by forgetting which river that was on, but one of the rivers.
I think it's the Tennessee River.
I think it was the Tallapoosa. Honestly, it wasn't the Tennessee, though. It was,
okay.
It was
All right.
One of the ones that we don't have up here. Anyway, there was a bend in the river that's called Horseshoe Bend, and they, for the most part, slaughtered about 700 starving Creek people, men, wow, women, and children. It wasn't pretty, and it's not glorious. On the way home, Jackson started, and it wasn't all the Creek that were fighting against the United States at that during that little war. It was just like this one group of folks that we call the Red Sticks, Red Stick Creeks. But the other Creeks were fighting against them with Andrew Jackson, with the Cherokee. But on the way home, though, Jackson started trying to take the land of the people who had just fought with him. So he was trying to take the Creek land and Cherokee land in Alabama. And he wasn't able to hold on to that Cherokee land at that point. He did get some of the Creek land, though.
Wow.
And yeah. And then, of course, he goes on to, lots of fame in bloody glory, and gets elected president a few years later. And forgets his alliances because he's a land speculator and he wanted land.
right.
To sell.
So you have spent 4 years working on your degree there at MTSU, and your dissertation. Tell us what kind of product that is.
Well, good grief.
I looked at the title, and you have You've called it a cultural landscape.
It's a,
Tell
it is.
us, tell us, tell us what that the title is, and what exactly you were trying to do with your dissertation.
So it's called Forming Red Clay, a Cultural Landscape History of Red Clay State Historic Park. And I don't look just at the park, though. I'm looking at the area around it as well. But I started out talking about the Cherokee history and up into removal. And then I do switch over for a few chapters and talk about the settlers who came afterwards. That the land that makes up the park actually was sold in two different land allotments, so or land grants, and it was held by those first families until a decade or two after the Civil War. And it was always farmland, either actually being tilled or for pasturage, up until the state bought it. The only part that has ever been commercially developed is the railroad that runs through the eastern section of the park. And that was put in, well, the plans for it were laid before the Cherokee were removed. But the tracks that in the depot at Red Clay did not open. There was actually a depot there on the park or right off the park land. And that opened in 1852. There were three Civil War skirmishes there as well. Including it being a staging area for the 15th Army of the Ohio when they were about to go down and join Sherman on the march through Georgia.
Wow, interesting.
Of course the railroad got tore up during all those little skirmishes and stuff, but they rebuilt it really quickly, and there was a little town of Red Clay, Georgia, just literally across the border, that got started right after removal and grew until the 1880s, when another line was put down to what is now Cahutta, Georgia. It was just a it was called Parker's Woodyard before. And because I was, like I was saying, it's in that the Ridge and Valley region, the topography didn't allow them to put a new railroad spur into Red Clay where the first depot was. So they had to go a couple miles south to what is now Cahutta, Georgia. And that little line connected Cahutta to Ooltewah, Tennessee.
I see. Yeah, right.
And that little thing's called the Ooltewah Cutoff. And it made it a lot easier for folks who wanted to go between, I think, Chattanooga and, was it Dalton? If you wanted to go, I think, trying to remember, it was some weird, convoluted way that people would have to go because they had to go from like Chattanooga to Cleveland and then down to Dalton, instead of going straight. There wasn't like a straight line from Chattanooga to Dalton early on. And so when they put in the Ooltewah Cutoff, they could just go up to Ooltewah and then down to Dalton. But when Cahutta was established, you had more easier rail connections there. So the whole town, pretty much, of Red Clay, Georgia, moved 2 or 3 miles south to Cahutta. And so if you go to the park now, you'll see like remnants of, like, there's this little tiny community just across the border there. But if you go on down a couple miles, then you run into Cahutta.
I
And
got it. I got it. So this cultural landscape, and you're describing, assembling geographic and historical information about this particular place from a long timeline.
Right.
And this is a tool that managers of cultural resources use so they don't make mistakes in the management of their properties. Is
sure.
that?
Well, I mean, as a historian, you know, history doesn't stop. When you classify something like Red Clay as a historic site, and you limit it to those, you know, very short, you know, that historic span of 1832 to 1838, you cut out all the other stuff. And the other
stuff
is
the complete
just
picture,
as awesome.
Right.
It's just as interesting, I think, as what came earlier. I mean, because we do have artifacts there from well before that period of significance. Of course, things are still happening there now.
Sure.
So,
Even the history of the promoters of the Red Clay State Park area to begin with. I mean, the state just didn't acquire that property, you know, on its own motion, so to speak. The people in Bradley County in that area promoted that as a potential state park for years and years prior to the state acquiring it.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting people too. Some of whom I met still promoting it. So you know, one of the interesting experiences that I recall too in modern, you talk about history not stopping. In 1884, the Cherokee had a reunion there, didn't they?
It did. It was so one of my favorite stories about Red Clay. And go there and you see that there's an eternal flame, but you don't understand what it is. So what happened when that last council was had in 1837? The sacred fire, the Cherokee are sometimes called the people of the fire, because fire is sacred. And the keeper of the fire took the embers from that council fire at Red Clay and kept them alive all along the trail. It was split up into at least four different fire pots and taken on different detachments all the way to Oklahoma. And it was relit and split even more. So over a century later in 1951, when the Eastern Band were starting up their outdoor drama Unto the Hills. I don't know if you've ever gone over there to see that over in Cherokee.
In Cherokee, sure.
One of the promotional things they did was that four of the Eastern Band elders traveled to Tahlequah, Oklahoma, along the Trail of Tears, and they talked one of the fire keepers into letting them take or start some charcoal embers of their own from that sacred fire. And then they had it in a bucket and they put it in the back of a pickup truck, and somebody sat in the back with it from Oklahoma, North Carolina, tending it the entire time. And they relit it, or they lit the eternal flame over at their big amphitheater where they do that play. And the fire that's there now is in a different fireplace thing than the original one.
Okay.
But it's still the same fire. And so in 1984, the Eastern Band and the Cherokee Nation, their histories had diverged. You know, they were over 1,000 miles apart. Their cultures kind of started changing because, Eastern Band were mostly left alone because they were kind of in this remote part of the mountains. But when the Great Smoky Mountain National Park was getting ready to open, some of the park promoters were like, ooh, we've got this quote unquote exotic thing here in the Appalachians. we've got these Cherokee that are still living here. And so they started promoting the Cherokee as a tourist industry. And so you have some strange things that happen over there, like some of the Eastern Band folks would put on Plains Indian headdresses, and you can still see some of them doing this performative thing called chiefing.
Yeah, I had a buddy that was a physician over there in Cherokee years ago, and he said that the locals refer to it as chiefing.
Yep.
And you know, the standing on the corner and having your picture taken with the tourists mm-hmm. for a, you know, a $5 tip or whatever they might get, but totally inappropriate costume to their culture.
Right. Yeah. Right. There's a really excellent book, if you ever want to read it, called Public Indians, Private Cherokees.
Say and the name again.
Public Indians, Private Cherokees.
Okay. All right.
You know, and it really talks about how the Eastern Band folks, they do this because this is how they survive. It's how they supported their families for decades, was to, you know, give white tourists what they thought an Indian looked like.
Right.
Now they don't, it's not as prevalent now as it used to be, but they did do that. The Cherokee Nation didn't have to do that.
Right.
They were removed, they were severed from the homeland, but that did allow them not to have to pander to white people as much.
So they had a meeting in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
You were telling a story about the fire.
I'm getting there. I'm sorry. I'm a historian. I will go on. So anyway, but by 1984, they really weren't talking so much. They really did not have hardly anything to do with each other. However, the two chiefs, Chief Swimmer from the Cherokee Nation and Chief Young Deer from the Eastern Band, decided that they needed to get their people together. And so they held the very first joint council between the Eastern Band and the Cherokee Nation in 147 years. And at the opening ceremony of the joint council, seven runners came, they ran with torches that they lit from the sacred fire or the eternal flame in North Carolina, ran 140 something miles to Red Clay to light the eternal flame there. So it's the same fire. The same fire has been burning there for, oh, what is it now, 182, 83 years?
It's a great story.
Yeah.
That was a fun event. In preparation for us getting together, I asked my wife if she still had the T-shirt that she that she got on the on that at that event. I know that unfortunately the T-shirt is long gone, but it was a fun event.
I was going to get a picture of that just to put in our digital exhibit.
Well, I'd sure wish that we had it. It was because it had the date of the event and the whole thing on it. You know, so you have gotten your degree now, and tell us what the future holds for you, Danielle.
Well, I currently am working for the U.S. Forest Service as a historian. It's a term appointment, but I'm hoping to find a more permanent position in the federal service.
What sort of work, just curiously, what sort of topics do they have you working on?
Oh, we are working on, we do a lot of National Register projects.
I see.
Any kind of public history project that the Forest Service needs, we are capable of doing. The Forest Service, it's kind of funny. They've got over 600 archaeologists. There are eight of us historians in all of the Forest Service. So there's a lot of work for us to do.
Well, and it makes the point that if you are a land manager, particularly in the eastern United States, chances are you have something of cultural significance on your land,
Absolutely.
and it's in our state parks are not, we have some parks like Red Clay and Sycamore Shoals, Fort Loudoun, that are historic in their conception. But even the natural parks like Fall Creek and the bigger areas of forested areas, there are way significant cultural things on those properties as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Tennessee, we live in a naturally wealthy place. I mean, there was a time when there were buffalo here.
Sure.
There were, you read like some of the, well, kind of romanticized a little bit, but I don't know if it's too romanticized, the accounts of what it was like before white people came to Tennessee, and it sounded like Eden. I mean, you just walk outside, shoot a deer, you got supper for the family. I mean, not quite like that anymore, but yeah. So of course there were people living here, people have been living in this part of North America for I think 11,000 years. There the evidence of that is everywhere if you look closely enough. So,
Well, Danielle, thank you so much for agreeing to spend some time with us. I commend our audience to check out Red Clay State Park and the article that you've written in the most recent Tennessee Conservationist if they want to get more in depth about it. But thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you the best in your endeavors out in the future.
thank you so much.
Hold on a second, I did the wrong thing.
Uh-oh. Yeah, see, it's still recording.